Very exciting to be able to give this talk to all of you. Sadly, not in person, but it's the way the world is right now. I'm gonna tell you a story that started in conversations with my friend Felix, who overlapped with me while we both actually lived in Canada, but we actually never wrote a paper together while we lived there. But you know, over discussions, these things can happen. So the basic story that I want to tell you is about things that can happen in the space of solutions to Einstein's equations. And I'm in particular going to tell you a story that happens in an ensemble of fixed total charge in Einstein-Maxwell theory in 4D flat space. And this part of the talk is going to be a review of a classic paper from 1998. So the basic idea is that you can consider Einstein-Maxwell theory in four dimensions. And if you make the following ansatz for your metric and your gauge field, then the Einstein's equations and the Maxwell's equations collapse to the following equation. So you just have one function's worth of degrees of freedom, h, which depends on these positions x, on these coordinates x. And the whole set of equations boils down to the Laplacian of h equals zero. So h has to be a harmonic function up to sources. And so the general solution to this is just 1 plus q over r. And these q's and these x's are free parameters. You can place these objects wherever you want. And what they are the positions of extremal black holes. So these q's are the charges of each individual black hole. And the x is the position, xa are the positions of their individual horizons. And we're allowing for a constant solution to this equation, but it's not necessary to solve the equations of motion. You can drop it. If you keep it, then the total solution is flat space at large distance, at large x. But if you drop it, then the solution is ADS2 times S2. So let's consider two options. One is where you have two black holes that are on top of each other. So you just have ADS2 times S2 everywhere with total charge Q1 plus Q2. And the other is the following scenario where you split the two charges into two different black holes. Very far up the throat of this geometry, the metrics are essentially equivalent up to subleading terms. But as you approach each individual horizon, then the geometry splits into two separate ADS2 times S2s, each one with its own ADS2 radius determined by the scale Q1 or Q2. So these geometries represent a kind of radial flow that interpolates from one ADS2 times S2 and infinity to a pair of them. And they're both solutions with the same essentially asymptotics. Now, the difference between these two geometries is not invisible at infinity. It's actually present in the multiple moment of the electrostatic field. But the metric is the metrics match onto each other. There's another interesting fact, and that fact is that there exists a Euclidean instanton that was discovered in 1992 that mediates between these two geometries. So when we have two geometries mediated by a Euclidean instanton, we think of them, each asymptotic state in the Euclidean geometry, as a state in the free energy landscape. And the instanton action is like a tunneling action. So you can think of the single black hole as one possible state in some free energy landscape, and the pair of bifurcated horizons as some other state. And the existence of this instanton tells you that a single black hole is unstable to bifurcating in this way, quantum mechanically. So that thing is called the fragmentation instability, this very general thing that I'm talking about. So the question, given the existence of such an instability in a very simple scenario, which is the scenario of fixed charge Einstein-Maxwell theory in four dimensions, how can we describe it using the tools that we have built over the last few years? In particular, since we understand now that when we have an ADS2 or an ADS2 times S2, there is an emergent low energy description, which is given by an SYK model. It might have a UV completion as a disordered fermionic system, for example, like the SYK model. But if that's the case, how do we accommodate, or how would we perturb such models that only describe one ADS2 to models that allow for multiple fractionating horizons and a flow from one ADS2 to two? So that's the question. That is the motivation for this study. This is what got us interested to begin with. And let me tell you a few more things that we should try to aim for if we can understand if we're on the right track for building a dual, which is we want to find order parameters in our dual that can match on to, for example, the different multiple moments that you read off from the electrostatic field at infinity. Moreover, it seems like this potential, this separation between two horizons is free, is a free number. It doesn't spoil the asymptotic ADS2 symmetries. And so we should think about it like the existence of a marginal operator in our theory. So if we're on the right track, then we should see something like this. Now, I want to say that these things are things that we're going to aim for, and the story is not complete. So, if you have any ideas, please interrupt me and let me know if you have any thoughts. So, before we get on to the model that I'm going to discuss, I'm going to take a brief detour and describe the exact same types of geometries that I mentioned before, but in string theory. So in string theory, in low energy approximations to string theory, namely supergravity in four dimensions, you also have such fragmented black hole solutions. And these fragmented black hole solutions are much more complicated. They're more rigid. They're not necessarily allowed to move with respect to each other because apart from the electromagnetic forces between these black holes, there are also scalar forces that make these black holes rigid. Yeah, one thing that I wanted to mention is that the reason that in Einstein-Maxwell theory, the black holes are allowed to move freely around each other is that the electrostatic repulsion of these black holes cancels exactly against the gravitational attraction. That's why you have a free parameter. In these string theoretic constructions, that doesn't happen because there are additional forces. Anyway, that's not an important fact. The thing that I wanted to mention is that on the weak coupling side, the models that give rise to these black holes, these fragmented multi-centered black holes, can be obtained by considering string theory compactified on some Calabi-Yau, where you allow d-brains to wrap certain cycles. The effective field theories that describe these are supersymmetric, so they have bosons and fermions. And if you can take the limit where the Calabi-Yau has a very large volume, then the effective theory can be thought of as a quantum mechanics. Now, the quantum mechanics in question has the following structure. All the details are not important, but the structure is as follows. There are bosons and fermions. So the bosons are these fields phi, and the fermions are these fields psi. So you can think of, and the symmetries of the model allow you to specify some arbitrary function W, which is called the superpotential. And that thing is not fixed. It would depend on the Calabi-Yau data, for example. It's some complicated function. And this superpotential W tells you how the bosons interact amongst themselves, as well as how the bosons interact with the fermions. So there will be multi-body interactions, bosons with fermions, and bosons with bosons. And there's additional terms just among the bosons that are not specified by the superpotential that is like a quartic term, but one that where you can satisfy an equation such that you find a vanishing contribution from this. So you can see where we're going, hopefully. But the point is that if the Calabi-Yau is super complicated, then you can consider its data as some disordered parameter. And if you consider it as some disordered parameter, it's going to be the thing that we're going to want to integrate over. So we're going to consider models where we have a potential that's disordered with a disordered coupling that we're going to integrate over, very similar to an SYK. And the reason that we do this is because we don't have access necessarily to particular string compactifications because they're so complicated or because we just don't know about them. But moreover, there's a constraint. So trying to minimize this constraint tells you that the bosons are not really completely free, but near the ground states, they realize some nonlinear sigma model on some manifold. Okay, so that's the string theory aside. We want a model like that because we know the string theoretic models admit supersymmetric multi-centered black holes, but we're not gonna focus on supersymmetry or all the complications. We're gonna try to take all of those features that are available in that model and try to simplify it as much as we can. Okay, so instead what we're gonna do, instead of that complicated model I wrote down, we're going to just consider a p-body interaction of bosons. We're going to ignore the fermions completely because the fermions, we're going to think about that like SYK physics. SYK physics we understand, and we're going to try and solve a different model. And this model is known as the p-spin model. It's a very famous model studied in spin glass literature and condensed matter and statistical physics. And you'll see that it shares a lot of features with that string theoretic model that I described earlier. The idea is that you take some n-body interaction. Okay, so now instead of considering a superpotential, we're just going to assume that the potential itself is disordered with the disordered coupling. This will mimic the unknowns that we had from before. And instead of having that quartic potential fixed on the bosons, we're going to impose on this path integral the following constraint, that the sigmas obey that their sum is equal to n. So these sigmas are actually going to parameterize the sigma model of an n-dimensional sphere of radius n, of radius root n. And it's very important that we do this in this model because unlike the SYK model, which is a theory of fermions, if we have negative directions in our potential with bosons, that's very bad unless we somehow constrain the moduli space of these bosons to be compact. So we're gonna take this disordered model, but we're gonna impose this constraint. And it's very important because these are bosons. Are there any questions at this point? Okay, so this model is very similar to SYK, except that because these are bosons, we have a quadratic kinetic term. And that quadratic kinetic term, you might have noticed, is not canonically normalized. The reason that it's not canonically normalized is because we have fixed instead the size of this sigma model manifold. And the expense that comes with that is that we have non-canonically normalized fields. We could instead choose to canonically normalize, but then the free parameter would be the size of this manifold. So at the end of the day, we only have two dimensionless parameters. Those are m over beta and the n beta times j. So we have one extra dimensionless parameter over the normal SYK. Okay, so now what happens? So we're going to disorder average this model, like I mentioned, and we're interested in studying the free energy of this model, because that's the thing that we do in statistical physics, which means that we disorder average the log of the partition function, which means that we need to be able to solve this partition function for arbitrary couplings. And that is very hard to do. So the order of computing the partition function, taking its log, and then disorder averaging is the hard step. So what we're going to do is we're going to do what any good physicist does, is to use a trick. That trick is the replica trick, which everybody should be familiar with. We're going to take this representation of the logarithm as the partition function to the power n, take its derivative, and then send n to zero. And the reason that this is a trick is because we're going to compute this quantity, the partition function to the power n, only when n is an integer, and then assume that that approximation or that calculation is valid for real n, which is a step that some mathematicians find abhorrent, but we're physicists, so it's okay. So now we replicate our model n times. So we have this new index A, which goes from one to little n, the coupling, which doesn't depend on A, and we have an extra term that I hadn't written down before with a new field. These fields are Lagrange multipliers. They impose the spherical constraint for every little n, for every little A. So now, when we disorder average, as usual, we have a model where the replicas are completely decoupled. And integrating out this disorder couples the replicas. And in the end, you can write down an effective theory. These are the mesons of the theory. The ON symmetry drops out. We are left with singlets of the ON. But the remaining symmetry is the permutation symmetry on the labels of this, of the replicas. So we're left with an effective theory in replica space. So we've completely integrated out the sites that these bosons live on. And this effective theory looks as follows. It should be somewhat familiar to you if you have studied the SYK model, but if you haven't, then it's okay. The only difference is the existence of this quadratic kinetic term rather than a linear one, because we're dealing with bosons, as well as this spherical constraint, which I've rewritten. And we can compute the Schwinger-Dyson equations. They're exact and they're given by this. And if we assume that the model is obeys replica symmetry, so that means that these Q variables are only diagonal, so zero on the off diagonal, then we're left with equations of motion that at low energies give rise to known late time conformal solutions, very much like the SYK model. However, the approximation that this Q matrix is diagonal is true if you have a model of fermions, but is not true in practice if you're allowing yourself to have bosons. And the reason for that is that bosons can have VEVs. So, so what happens is that the off-diagonal terms in this matrix split. So this overline is a disorder average, and this bracket is a thermodynamic average. And this split happens for the off-diagonal terms, and you see that you get products of one-point functions. And for fermions, these one-point functions vanish, which is why you don't expect a spin glass transition in these fermionic models. But when you have bosons, these bosons can pick up webs, and therefore you're allowed to break this replica symmetry. And replica symmetry breaking is intricately linked with the physics of spin glasses. Are there any questions at this point? All right. So what do we do? Well, we need to figure out now how to solve this model, given that the allowed solutions are not necessarily diagonal in replica space. Actually, what happens is that if you assume that the solution is diagonal in replica space, you observe that your solution makes no sense at low temperatures, because you predict something like negative entropies for the thermodynamic state, and so on and so forth. So it turns out that you actually have to confront this problem head on, that the thermodynamic state forces you to consider replica matrices that have values on the off diagonals. And then the question is, how do you populate these off diagonals? And it should be clear from this equation that the off diagonals have to be constants, because one point functions, there's no time translation here. So the one point functions will not depend on time. Okay, so what happens? Well, it turns out that you can break the symmetry, but in a particular way. You can break the replica symmetry in a particular way by assuming that your matrix is populated by boxes of size n. So remember, this is a matrix in replica space. So we have a matrix of size little n times little n. And each matrix of size little n times little n can be broken up into boxes of size m by m. So here m is 3. And you can split it up into clusters as so. And it turns out that if you write a matrix like this, this is called a one replica symmetry breaking matrix. Because in the diagonals, I have replica symmetric matrices. That just means that all the off diagonals are the same. But I've populated this matrix with replica symmetric matrices along the diagonals. So here's a little quiz to see if anybody's paying attention. How would I build a two replica symmetry breaking matrix? I guess that's a tough one. So in order to build a two replica symmetry breaking matrix, you put one replica symmetry breaking matrix along the diagonals of a replica symmetry breaking of a replica symmetric matrix, and so on and so forth. And this is actually what won Parisi his Nobel Prize, this discovery. It's a beautiful fact about physics, the physics of spin glasses, that they actually have in these disordered landscapes a beautiful underlying structure. Okay, so how do we proceed? Well, it turns out that the solution of this model is just it stops at one replica symmetry breaking. You don't have to go further. There are other models where actually, the solution goes all the way to infinite step, and those are very complicated statistical mechanical models. But it turns out that this model of a spin glass is the easiest one to solve, because the solution stops at one RSP. Sorry about that. Yeah, So the solution stops at one RSD. And so there's only one extra parameter that you have to solve for, this quantity U, as well as actually another one, which is the size of this box. The size of this box, which is not usually a parameter in your theory, becomes a parameter that you have to solve. So you get two new parameters that you have to solve for in order to solve this model complete, this U and the size of this box, which I've called M. Okay, so on this solution, the Schwinger-Dyson equations become the following. They're very similar to the, like I mentioned before, they're very similar to the ones of SYK, except for the fact that the kinetic term is quadratic, and you have introduced this new quantity U, which appears. And you also have to impose a boundary condition, which is coming from the spherical constraint. And all of these things are very important in solving the model. It makes it actually pretty hard to solve for the dynamics. Okay, well, at high temperatures, this model should not be in a spin glass phase. So this quantity U vanishes. And if the quantity U vanishes, then you get these, like I was mentioning before, you get these low energy equations that are, essentially conformal. But these low energy equations are actually not the global minimum. So at high temperatures, you get a gapped phase. You don't get a conformal solution. And at low temperatures, you expect the spin glass. So at low temperatures, what happens is that this U, these off-diagonal quantities become non-zero, pick up BEVs for the overlaps between different thermodynamic states. And your Schwinger-Dyson equations become very interesting in that case. In that case, what happens is that to leading order in U, so this gamma is a U-dependent quantity, it's one over U squared, you get a very symmetric looking equation. And if you just massage it a little bit, so of course, in order to get here, I had to solve the spherical constraint. So I've removed it. This is what gives you all these delta functions, et cetera. And what happens is that you, just by staring at this equation, you're led to consider writing this two-point function of your spin variables as follows. There's a contact term, and then we're going to parametrize the remaining piece like so, like the derivatives of this quantity y. Well, if you do that, then actually the equation of motion for y becomes exactly the free SYK equations of motion. So what is called the Q equals 2 SYK. And Q equals 2, we know that the conformal dimension of these fields in SYK have dimension 1 over Q. So that means that this Y field is the correlator for a conformal field of dimension 1/2. But this Q, which is the field of interest, is the derivative of Y. So it's a descendant. But importantly, it has dimension delta equals 1. So it transforms like a descendant field, but it has dimension 1. And that's interesting because that is the exact dimension of a marginal operator in a conformal quantum mechanics. So, and this is why I tried to mention earlier in the talk about these black holes that are allowed to move freely about each other, that there should be some marginal operator. Perhaps the indication that we're on the right track is that in this type of model, we've identified the field of interest has the conformal dimension of the marginal operator. Okay, but there are caveats. The reason that this is an actually interesting solution is that remember how I mentioned that this the in the replica matrix, we have a free parameter. That free parameter is the size of this box. It tells you basically that in the space of states, you have a clustering property, and that clustering property tells you that you have certain states that are closer in distance than others, and states that are within a particular cluster are closer in this space of states. If you're further away, then you're further in the space of states. So there is actually a metric on the space of states that is defined by these overlaps. And this U is one of them. One way to see that is that this U is actually a dot product between two vectors. Okay. So now the size of this cluster needs to be, in the thermodynamic limit, needs to be fixed by something. And on this solution that shows the emergent conformal symmetry, you can just show that the value of M that you need, which I haven't written down, does not satisfy the Schwinger-Dyson equations. You have to somehow free it. But that's okay. We can think of, so M, remember, is telling you that the existence of a non-zero M is telling you that you have a model. You start off with a model that's replica symmetric. You do the disorder averaging, and you ultimately land on a low temperature solution that explicitly breaks the replica symmetry. And M tells you how that explicit breaking of the replica symmetry happens. Now, what you could do instead is explicitly break the replica symmetry, and then you're allowed to set M as you choose. So you can go through the entire construction that I showed in the beginning of the talk here, but now consider the model with replicas N as our fundamental model, and then introduce an explicit coupling between replicas, but only within an M by N block. And if we do that, then we're allowed to fix M to be whatever we want. It's a free thermodynamic parameter, and we've entered the grand canonical ensemble of the replica symmetry breaking. And M becomes a thermodynamic parameter. It's a very interesting one. So M now acts like a fugacity for the free energy, just like beta acts like a fugacity for the energy in the thermodynamic sense. And so this slide is just for analogy. If you have a regular thermodynamic ensemble, you compute the partition function and the saddle point, then—
Sorry, Tarek, there is a question in the chat.
Yeah.
And if you can see it, I can read it. I thought M was determined by some complicated equations, but now we are choosing it.
Ah, yeah. Good. Yeah, so in the beginning, I said that U and M they're determined by some complicated equations. I didn't write them down, but if you want to track them down, they're in our paper. The interesting point was that you realize that you can get what looks like a conformal solution, but that conformal solution is not a solution to the equations of motion, but only for M. Only is M the thing that doesn't satisfy its equation of motion. U satisfies its equation of motion. Q satisfies its equation of motion. You've satisfied the spherical constraint. So this seems like a very reasonable state to consider, so long as you're allowed to set M yourself. And the thing that I was trying to mention is that you are allowed to set M not in this ensemble, but in another ensemble. And the other ensemble is one where you actually by hand explicitly break the replica symmetry. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So, So by analogy with the normal thermodynamic case, you see, you have this parameter beta, which represents how you populate your energy states in some thermodynamic ensemble. And then on the saddle, the T derivative of your free energy tells you how many states are there, how many thermodynamic states have this energy. A very similar thing happens with M. So now instead, when you take a derivative with respect to M of M phi, your grand canonical free energy, you get the free energy of your state. And the 1 over M derivative computes an entropy-like quantity, which sadly has a name that matches with something that we say now in high energy, but the name in statistical physics predates it, so I'm going to use it. This entropy-like quantity is called the complexity of the system, and it counts the number of free energy states in this band of 1 over M. So really what happens is that because you're allowing yourself to move in the number of replicas that are coupled, and you're allowing to tune that quantity as you like, you get to see how many states in this landscape have a free energy within a band. And that count is the complexity. So it's a very interesting fact. So there are some open questions here that I don't have an answer to. The open questions are, 1, can we tie the appearance of this non-zero overlap to some non-zero dipole moment or multipole moment in the space of low temperature black hole configurations? How do the multipole moments of the electrostatic field imprint themselves in the parameters of the effective theory? So you would want to think that there is some phase which is ordered where there are no dipoles, there are no quadrupoles, there are no sextuples. And then as you tune some parameter, maybe it's not the temperature because all of these extremal black holes in Einstein-Maxwell theory are zero temperature, but some other parameter, some bias, and all of a sudden you spontaneously break your order and you're in a disordered state. And that disordered state is measured by these multiples, these electrostatic multiples. So is that the same in this model, like where we have now introduced a new variable, which is this overlap between different states? And can we somehow tie that to the physics of these black holes? And I think another intriguing question is, can we tie the existence of this marginal operator to the moduli space mechanics of these separate ADS2 black holes, because they're somehow allowed to freely move around each other? Does this tell you that the radial mode is somehow free? And one other question that I think it would be interesting to try to understand is this quantity sigma, which counts the complexity in the spin level, somehow calculating some regularized moduli space of the volumes of the throats? Is it telling you how many configurations exist? So in Einstein-Maxwell theory, that volume is infinite because you can have infinitely separated black holes or very small separated black holes. There's nothing that constrains that. But maybe this sigma is a more finite quantity that you could relate to that volume, some regularized volume. Are there any questions at this stage? Okay. So this model obviously has its faults. One of them is that, of course, we only had one parameter in this model, and these multiple moments, there would be an infinite number of them. So, of course, if we're doing a good job, then we would have an infinite number, or we'd have much, much more interesting pattern of replica symmetry breaking. But I think in order to just build up the intuition, it's good to study easier models rather than harder models. All right. So in this last section, I'm going to tell you about another feature of these models that we can study, which is their out-of-time order correlators, which are interesting to high energy physicists, but when you talk to people in the spin glass community, they seem almost entirely uninterested in OTOCs. But because this crowd is more high energy focused, I figured I'll let you know what this model entails. Okay, so in order to probe whether or not this this model scrambles, we have to study the four-point function of these fields. And usually the way that that goes is that you derive something called the ladder kernel, and then you try to invert it. And the four-point function is formally the inverse of this ladder kernel, which is a function on four times. And the inverse is in the sense of convolution. So that means the products are taken by convoluting against two times. And studying this model is difficult because not only do we, in the spin glass phase, have these additional parameters to deal with, which are U, the overlaps between the states, but we also have a four-point equivalent of it, which for lack of a better letter, we called V, which is only non-zero in the spin glass phase. It takes this value in the spin glass phase. And interestingly, is just something that is that appears in the formal expression. But you know, the fact that it appears has to have implications, and we are definitely interested, although we haven't done this, in understanding the implications of the existence of these parameters on these four-point functions in general. For example, what is their imprint on the field content or on the OPE, if there is one, of you know, in this field theory? And moreover, these Qs, remember, they don't transform nicely under the conformal symmetry in this marginal phase. They are they act like descendant fields. So it becomes very difficult to actually formally invert this problem. So instead, we have to do it numerically. And here I'm going to show you a little phase diagram. So here is the phase diagram in terms of our dimensionless couplings. This is the T direction. And this is the 1 over mj direction. Remember, m is the normalization of the kinetic term. And the spin glass phase is denoted by this red line. So as you lower the temperature or as you lower m, you hit a spin glass phase. But notice that the spin glass phase doesn't exist for arbitrarily small m. And that's because for small m, you can have wild kinetic terms that break your rigidity, the rigidity of your model. Your model is not going to be glassy because it's not going to be kinetically bound. So you really need to tune M to be big and T to be low in order to hit the spin glass. And then what's interesting is that if you do that, you'll find that everywhere on this phase diagram is the model chaotic. The model has an exponential otoc everywhere, which was very shocking to me because this is supposed to be a spin glass. And so I find it very interesting that even below the spin glass transition, do you have modes that scramble very efficiently? Of course, at strictly zero temperature, the scrambling exponent goes to zero, but it's non-zero for any finite temperature. I think that that's pretty interesting. Because, you know, we think of glasses as rigid objects. So I guess, at least for me, maybe somebody in the audience knows, has a better intuition than I do. It seems surprising that such a thing would happen. Perhaps the rigidity is meant in a different sense. Okay. So today we discussed what I think is a very nice transition in general relativity that I think would be interesting to understand. We proposed the Troy model that may or may not share features with this set of geometries in bulk. We discussed some connections to string theory that these models have. And I mentioned that we would like to try to understand this effective field theory from the bulk side in order to see how we can make progress and connections with these toy models. And that's actually a work in progress with some people here in Amsterdam, namely Alejandro Castro, Gara Toldo, and Evita Verheyen. All right, that's all I have.
Thank you very much for a very nice talk. Are there any questions for Tarek?
Maybe I can ask a question. Sorry, if no one else wants to. But it's a bit sort of like out there, but I mean, you'd sort of in between motivated the whole thing by some Calabi-Yau compactifications where you sort of say, okay, like the couplings are some intersection numbers of your Calabi-Yaus. But then in the end, in your model, you have the standard sort of SYK measure for integrating over couplings. I was just wondering if, I mean, is that a good model for like Calabi-Yau compactification, at least qualitatively, or?
Well, there's first of all, it's interesting for two reasons that your question, because first of all, the thing that you disorder in the Calabi-Yau is actually the superpotential coefficients, not the potential coefficients. I mean, potential is everywhere positive definite. And so, of course, if you disorder your, you can rephrase that as disordering your potential coefficients, but then it would be a different, distribution. I think strictly speaking, that distribution is known, but I don't remember the name. I think you can look up a paper by James Gates recently. But of course, you can ask, is the Gaussian measure on the space of these intersection numbers of the Calabi-Yau the good one? And of course, I don't have a good answer to that. I mean, one would have to do statistics on them. And I don't know if we have enough constructions, perhaps.
Yeah, I would have thought that this sounds like something that perhaps.
Yeah, people must know this. I have asked so many times people that. If such things are known, and I have not gotten a satisfactory answer. I think it would be interesting to understand. But yes, I agree with you. I don't know. So from this perspective, of course, like we're just trying to understand the most basic, construction would give. And of course, you know, it comes with the caveats of understanding, you know, where the assumptions lie, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think that anything really depends too strongly. Like, you can prove that in these spin glass papers, in spin glass models in general, very little depends on the ensemble that you choose. You know, it really depends on just the second moment, and then everything else drops out, for example. So maybe something here. Something with Calabi-Yau happens as well.
Okay, are there more questions? Well, if not, let's thank Tarek again.
Thanks, everyone.